To see examples of what we talked about on this episode, along with further information, go to bunchofdorks.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to
Two Dimension Podcast,
the comic book podcast
with no direction.
Hello, my name is Don Moore, and you're listening to Two Dimension, the comic book podcast with no direction. And here with me today is a human being that knows something about the acoustics of life. It can only be...
Wow, Al, I didn't know about the acoustics of life. I know about the acoustics of guitars, maybe, but not life. Wow, that's I never heard of that before.
Well, when we came in here, one thing Al were talking about, which we talk about quite a bit, was comic book movie adaptations back in the day.
Yep.
And when we were kids, Dell Comics, which was at the time the biggest publisher in the United States, they had the Disney franchise, all the Carl Barks Disney stuff was out there. They did a lot of television adaptations, a lot of TV shows.
Yeah. Get Smart and, F Troop and all those.
Yeah, F Troop, a lot of the sitcoms. But what I always liked when I was a kid, they'd have photos of the show or the movie.
The covers would be photos a lot of times.
Well, they had Star Trek, too.
Yeah, Gold Key did Star Trek, yeah. Well, that's the one where Spock had the extra long big ears or whatever.
Yeah, but they all had all kinds of stuff. They had Turok, Son of Stone, which was one I always liked a lot. But they did a lot of movies.
Space Family Robinson, which wasn't really lost in space, even though they were almost concurrent in a weird
way. Yeah, well, they called it, when I started reading it, the title said Lost in Space, and I'd buy it, but I thought, this isn't Lost in Space.
It did become Lost in Space, didn't it? But it started first as Space Family Robinson.
Yeah, it was called Space Family Robinson, wasn't it?
But it was, I've seen them, but I never really read them. I don't know if at one point it became the Robinson family, or if it was just... I don't know if it started off as a TV adaptation.
Yeah, and that never was. I think they just used the name because it was a popular show. That's why I bought it.
And there's The Land of the Giants. I have that one, too.
Oh, that's right. They did do that.
They did those Irwin Allen movies. Yeah, they did some of those TV shows, too. Yeah, there's tons of them.
But I know they had, what do you call it,
Yellow
Submarine.
Of course, now we got to find all these images.
They had the Beatles Yellow Submarine, which we have talked about.
I bought that when I was a kid.
That was a nice one. It was big, like 64 pages.
Yeah, I bought that when I was a kid.
And that was actually pretty good.
There was other Beatle ones, too. Not A Hard Day's Night, but I could have sworn there was another Beatle. There was a Monkees comic book that I have somewhere. They actually did a Monkees.
Really?
Yeah, Jose Delbo drew it. I didn't know he was working in the 60s. But yeah, there's a Monkees. And there's going to be a new Monkees album coming out this year with some songs written by modern songwriters and some by them. They found an old Davy Jones unused track, which they're going to put on there, too. And they're going to tour, but not with Mike Nesmith. He's not going to tour. But he will be on the album. It's the 50th anniversary of the Monkees.
Yeah, I read some on Facebook. I just saw the picture of the three of them, an old picture of the three of them still around.
Yeah.
You ever heard Mike Nesmith early, his solo
work? I have
work?
One of them in there somewhere.
Maybe we could play that for the music break.
I'll find some,
The reason I ask is, when I got out of college...
It's very country.
When I got out of college, there was...
I used the early ones, man. Sorry.
It's okay. There was a guy I worked with that kept talking. This is when MTV was new. And he kept talking about Mike Nesmith, and he says, you can buy his albums at the store now. Really? Because to me, he was like old, long ago. And I'd always hear people say that, and I think Mike Nesmith was the main person behind MTV, putting it out. I never really heard his solo work.
He came out of he did a video called Elephant Parts, and I think that video was like almost like a template for MTV, but I could be wrong. It's been a while since I've seen it, but I think it was like some kind of, there's some connection there.
But I think he was one of the people behind it, started it.
You're probably right. Right.
I know I never saw any of his videos on MTV before I got access to it. The guy I was telling me all this stuff said there was a video about a weightlifter, there was a Mike Nesmith song.
Yeah, something Sam. Something.
But I guess he was making his own videos and stuff.
Sunset Sam. I remember a video like that. Some guy walking through Sunset Strip, like some muscle man or...
Okay.
Yeah, something along those lines.
Well, this Peter Tork came on the David Letterman show back in 82.
Yeah.
And I was kind of surprised at Peter Tork, because I haven't seen these guys since, I guess, the very early 70s. And he was talking and telling the history about the monkeys and stuff, and he said, he was talking about Mike Nesmith. He was doing his own songwriting, started doing his own solo work and putting out stuff. And a girl I was seeing at the time when I was talking about it, she says, oh, yeah, Mike Nesmith started doing his own solo work. So she was aware of it, but I never was. But nevertheless, he was one of the people. His mother invented liquid paper. And
yeah, she sure did.
Whenever you see anything about MTV in the history of it, Mike Nesmith somehow figures into it. But I think he was one of the people pushing it, promoting it.
He may have been. I just remember the video Elephant Park, which is really early VHS. And it got shown on television or somewhere along the line. I saw it. And he had videos and some comedy and some... He had some company called, I think, Pacific Arts. I'm getting all this screwed up because I really don't know. But he was definitely influential. But he put out a bunch of kind of like country-ish albums. You know, obviously he was from Texas and he had that feel to his voice. Even when he sang monkey songs, he did some of them with that country-ish feel to him or whatever, you know. So, but yeah, very good songwriter, but... You know, he did tour with the Monkees, I think, like a year or two ago, but I don't know if he wants to do it all the time, you know what I mean? But I thought Tork was sick, but I guess he's okay to tour. You know, Mickey Dolenz sang most of the hits, so, I mean...
I didn't know that.
Seems like it, doesn't it? I mean, you know, besides Davy Jones that did... He had a couple, but Mickey, you know, Mickey Dolenz in The Last Train to Clarksville and, you know, Hey Hey with the Monkees and Monkees Theme and... You know, a lot of those other big ones or whatever. You know, I mean, obviously, Davy Jones, a Daydream Believer and all that kind of stuff, you know. But, you know, he's Davy Jones was living in Florida, like somewhere in the middle of the state for a long time, you know, before he passed away. Yeah, he was living here. So, you know, I think he bred horses or he had something to do with horses because when he was young, he was a jockey, I think, or he was training to be a jockey. Yeah, there's some interesting Monkees documentaries on YouTube, and they definitely, for what it's worth, considering who's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, they definitely belong in there. They don't even sniff it, you know.
I've never been a Monkees fan. I mean, I know some of the songs, they're good songs, you know. I watched the show when I was a kid, but I don't know. To me, I just looked at it; they were just
not a big fan.
You know. Well, a lot of people are.
I'm actually a bigger fan now than I was of bubblegum music from that era than I was maybe 20 years ago, because I really do enjoy the fact that, you know, the musicians that played on them and the fact that they were very good musicians and they came up with ideas. Like, there's a documentary called The Wrecking Crew that talks about this, how these guys would, like, you know, hear a song and then they would come up with little, like, you know, gimmicks or whatever or little riffs and it would make the song, you know what I mean? And it was like, wow, these guys, they had the magic touch, you know, and they were played on a lot of Monkees records, you know, including all the Monkees were the beginning, and they were all covers. I mean, we're all like, you know, other the Brill Building, Don Kirshner, people writing for him, Carole King, Neil Diamond, and all that stuff. But to me, the songs hold up, and that's to me, not that we're going to get into a music show, but we kind of are. I don't care who sings it or who plays on it. If the song is good, it's going to be good. I mean, obviously, if it's not, you know, bad musicians, it might not be the greatest, but then somebody can get a hold of it and turn it into a good song. Kind of the same way with a comic book.
Well, my wife, coming to the Philippines the first year, she, whenever the Monkees came on the radio, she would turn it up, or television. She knew the songs, but to her, the Monkees was a singing group. She, you know, to me, I looked at it, they were kind of a manufactured television show.
Uh-huh.
But she saw it like you did, so...
Well, some idiots kind of think the Beatles were a manufactured group, too, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, the fact that they were, like, the guy, like, found them, and he dressed them up, and, he tried to create an image for them or whatever. I mean, yeah, if you want to get down to the, you know, if you want to take it to that level, yeah, they were somewhat manufactured, but... I think they achieved a lot more than just the Fab Four stuff. Or
well,
whatever.
they were different than anything else out there.
Yeah.
Basically, Brian Epstein just knew how to present them. And that's what that was. But
I mean, you read that comic book, too, The Fifth Beatle.
Yeah, that was a great one.
Yeah, so, but yeah, I, you know, there's always been comic book adaptations of TV shows. I mean, aren't there still some today?
That's what I was wondering about.
Yeah, like, Buffy the Vampire Slayer was a few years ago.
Yeah, well, Buffy was different because...
X-Files was a comic book.
Wasn't too. Buffy... Yeah, Buffy, when it was canceled, the creator of the show did a comic book for, like, the sixth season or something. He continued it on.
Yeah, yeah.
One problem with adaptations, they adapt the movie. And this is before home video, before you get VHS tapes or DVDs or, you know, whatever.
God,
you come
after.
There
was a time before that? Wow, that's crazy.
But, you know, to find anything else about the movie, you just buy the comic adaptation and you could read it and remember it. And so basically any movie that came out, you had one. Sometimes, rarely, they would try to continue it on after the movie and they'd have a running comic. Never as good. You know, it seemed like they kind of lost the gist of what it was. One of my favorite comic adaptations was Logan's Run.
Oh, the George Perez.
Yeah, George Perez and Claus Jansen were the art team. They
David
did,
Kraft, maybe?
David Kraft wrote issues 2 to 5. It was 5 issues. Archie Goodwin was the first writer.
Oh, okay.
And it was all good. David Kraft was fantastic, but the Archie Goodwin first issue, it rocks. But after the 5th issue, it basically finished the whole storyline, and the next issue came out, and I bought it and was really disappointed, but it was basically... what happened when they all left that Dome City, you know, and I thought, okay, and it's like, I don't know, they had a storyline, but it just seemed like the whole thing drug and there was nothing to it, and that's it. A lot of times after you do a movie adaptation and you try to keep the comic going, it's like, well, okay, what do we do now? And it just, you know.
I'd like them to see, this is kind of a bizarro idea, but I'd like them to do some company, if they could, which, you know, who knows, I mean, I guess it's a bizarre idea, do modern today, you know, get new people to do comic book adaptations of movies from, like, say, the 70s and the 60s that never had comic book adaptations. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, odd things like Zardoz or something like that. You know, do comic book adaptation of it or, I don't know. That's just the only one that comes to mind right now. But it'd be kind of interesting to see, like, you know, some weird kind of like, oh, okay, let's go reinterpret this, you know, this movie for comic books. And people would be going like, why? You know, well, why not? You know, we have the rights to it. I mean, Disney, you know what I mean? So there's been a lot of Disney adaptations, too, you know. I mean, Golki, yeah. And I mean, Dell did a lot of, you know, the Disney stuff and, you know, the Ducks. Was Golki, was Dell the Ducks?
It was Dell, and then later Dell turned into Golki.
Okay.
I don't know. I always thought it was the same place, but... somehow they split, and Western was Golki. So
and Whitman, was Whitman Golki?
Yeah.
Or is that another one?
Yeah, no, that's what I mean, Whitman. What did I say, Dell? No. When Dell stopped, Golki took over, but I think Golki was Whitman.
Whitman, okay.
But I know Dell, somehow that was Whitman as well, but it was Golki in the 70s. I don't know when it turned into Golki, but in the early 70s, I used to read them. And I know.
Did you get those in your town?
Oh yeah,
yeah, you did.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I had a lot of them. You remember OG Wiz? You might have been too old. Golki had their own character, and it was a boy that ran his own toy company called OG Wiz. And basically, it's like it was a small, kind of heavy boy with big round glasses. He always wore a business suit. It's kind of like a little old man, a little middle aged man, but he was a little boy. And he had a secretary who was, you know, a typical secretary, kind of Jacqueline Kennedy style. And they ran the toys company. And there was some guy, kind of a big heavy guy, kind of a Spanish-Italian type, that I guess was a competitor. Or somehow he was always trying to thwart him. And I mean, they were simply drawn. They weren't much. I found a couple online. As a kid, I was like 9 years old, 8, 9. I thought they were wonderful. Me and all my friends had them, but it was O period G period Wiz. But it was a boy that ran his own toy store company.
Was he like Richie Rich or something?
Sort of like Richie Rich, but he was kind of an intellectual boy, you know. And like I said, he was like, you ever seen cartoon kids that are kind of really like middle-aged people?
You know, like the big round glasses.
Big round glasses, but he had a big shock of black hair in the front, you know. And
sounds familiar.
It's It's kind of like the boy in Christmas Story. You know that actor, except he was a cartoon.
Yeah.
And
this is in the 70s.
Yeah, early 70s.
Oh, okay.
I don't know how long it ran, but I had three or four of them, and all the kids in my neighborhood, everybody had a couple, you know. But it was a Gold Key property. It ran for a while.
And it was created by them. It wasn't like a TV show or anything.
No, I never saw any. It was just theirs.
I'll find that one. I don't remember it.
It was simply drawn, but it was, like I said, I was a kid. I remember it fondly. When I found it online, I thought, well, that's not really, it's not really much now, but I remember it with fondness. It was kind of fun.
So when you said you got them as a kid, you got them from other kids, or did you have to go to the store to buy them?
No, I never bought them myself. I would get them in those three packs.
Oh, they came in the three packs. Those wonderful three packs.
Well, sometimes I get them. I think most of the kids, we had three packs for Christmas and a stocking. And it always had Disney characters. I remember my brother had one of Scamp. I guess that was the Lady
Scamp,
and Tramp's son.
Yeah.
And there'd always be an OG Wiz in it. I might have even bought an issue or two off the stands because I liked it enough, you know. But
did your parents ever stop you from buying a book?
No.
Oh, they never did. You ever went in the store and go, "Hey, I want this," and it was like Vampirella or something like that, and they said no.
Well, that if I would have, yeah, that would.
But you
have
never
been.
Did. Okay. All right.
But no, it's you know, there was clearly defined rules, and I was surprised. One of my best friends, his older sister, she was looking at the comics. He had a lot of Conan's, you know, superhero comics, and she says, "Well, do you have any Vampirella?" She was for real, you know, she was in her 20s, and we didn't. I never really saw Vampirella. I knew who she was. I see her in ads, but I was thinking, God, our parents would kill us if we had that, you know.
I got a Vampirella story. Well, I told you the one before when I bought the first issue. Well, my friend, who's coming down here in a couple of weeks, you know, when he was a kid, he wanted to get a back issue of Vampirella for some reason or another, because he had one and he wanted to get a back issue. So he went to the company, Captain Company, and he ordered a back issue. Somehow or another, the whole thing got screwed up and he ended up getting a subscription.
You told me
years.
That before, yeah.
Did I tell you that one on the air before?
Yeah, but keep going. I do remember
And then he had the subscription, and then he had a buddy of his who had another friend, and the buddy was really lusting after these Vampirellas. So, like,
that's how he got an old Spider-Man,
he got,
right?
He got Amazing Fantasy 15 for that. Yeah, that's a great one. You know, it's like, oh, you want these vampires? Your dad won't get them for you? Okay, well, you know, I got something you might... You got something I want. And he got that, and he ended up selling that stuff. It's like, oh, well.
Yeah, but I don't... Honestly, I don't see that as a loss, because I think that other boy was probably happy to get the Vampirellas.
Well,
you know,
if he would have kept the Amazing Fantasy, it would have been a loss. But, they didn't. They sold it for $50 or something a few years later. Or whatever. If he had it now,
a lot of money back then, though.
Yeah. In the early 70s, that was good change for a comic book. Yeah, you know, but if you kept it, it would have been like 50, whatever it is. You know, you want to think about that or whatever. But you never know how that goes. You know, things that you move, things stay behind or whatever. That was always a key book, though. Even back in the early 70s, that was always a key book. So, I mean, you knew it was the first appearance of Spider-Man. It was going to be a big deal, but, you know, kids, stuff changed hands a lot, you know, and, you know, deals were made and, you know, oh, yeah, I'll trade this for, you know, a bike or, you know, whatever, you know. But, yeah, the other kid got, like, 12 issues of Vampirella, which, if he kept them in good shape, could be very valuable, too, as we found out from going to, you know, Yancey Street. He had, like, some later issues in primo condition. He wanted $125 for them, but I don't think he'll ever get it, but, you know, that's
I don't
that.
Think he wants to sell them, honestly.
I think he wants some people to look at him and go, ooh.
Yeah, I think those probably mean something to him. That's what I would do if I had a store. There'd be certain books that I
you
wouldn't
to
mind
pay
selling.
For it.
But I really want them there, and I want them to be displayed. And I think it's, and there's nothing wrong with that, you know.
No.
I like they're preserved.
But if you want them to really, like, if you really want them to impress people with them, put them on the shelf. Don't hide them in a box in the back or whatever. You know, yeah, I remember stuff like that. Like dealers would have books, and you know they would price them to the point where they knew they weren't going to sell them, but they just look. People would come in to look at the expensive, cool books or whatever. So you know, whatever. You know. Hey, let's take a break and then let's take a break. You know, and then we'll come back and talk about you know, some stuff you got there or whatever.
Okay.
hoping to promote a dream somewhere along the way. You're rolling through the streets, looking for a disco, passing up the treats from a kid named Cisco, trying to make connections with their blemish-free complexions, and just as fate would have it, ended up with sunset sand. Sam was selling watches from a suitcase on a TV tray. And Lucy and Ramona were trying to figure out if he was gay. The three of them were standing, staring at each other, when the light behind their eyes blew each other's cover. The ancient code was branded, and each of them was handed a ticket to their kingdom, 'cause they saw their brother sunset sand. Lucy was from Compton, and she met Ramona at the zoo. Ramona was from Brooklyn, but she left when she was 22. Was a native of the Arizona desert, but he split when he was slated for some governmental make-work. Their differences subsided when the common bond was cited. They were all from the same place that made the famous sunset sand.
You can hear our most recent 20 episodes on iTunes. If you would like to hear our older episodes, you can find them on our blog. Just go to bunchofdorks.com and click on the Cyclops.
And that was Michael Nesmith from the Monkees and other things, including the creation of MTV with Cruisin' with Ramona and Sunset
Sam. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was a good song.
Yeah, that was from the video we were talking about, Elephant Parts. And we looked it up in the break, and yeah, Mike Nesmith created a show called Pop Clips, which eventually was sold to Warners and later became the basis for MTV. Didn't know that. Never saw Pop Clips. But you did, sir.
Yeah, I saw it, but it wasn't on Nickelodeon. They used to show it. It was syndicated late at night. I saw it in Oklahoma in like 82.
Yeah.
Or 83. And I remember a friend of mine said, Pop Clips, is that supposed to be for small children? Because, you know, it was kind of sophomoric and over the top, but known as Nickelodeon, it was fun. But they'd show videos, and they had this kind of cast. There were one woman was a Valley Girl. She's always doing the I'm So Sure and, you know, all that
Stuff. Yeah.
It was fun.
Did you ever see a show? It was around that same era. I can't think of the name of it now. But it was a summer repeat. It was a summer whatever show. And it was like they showed B movies, and one of it had some, and there were the people involved in the show. The cast were like running a movie theater. I know one of them was Lorraine Newman. Huh. I can't think of what the name show again. When we go to the next break, we'll look it up and we'll let you know. As a matter of fact, well, in a few minutes we'll do that. But it was like a summer TV show. She was in it. They were all in a movie theater. And they showed, like, you know, old Santo movies. Or
no, I've never heard of that.
It was sponsored by Dr. Pepper. I can't think of the name of it, but we'll talk about it later.
Cool. So, no. There's so many things I'm not aware of.
Well, you know, you can't watch everything. Even though back then we only had 3 or 4 channels. Even though I think that was during the cable days. That must have been 84. I wish I recorded it. I had a VCR. I never did.
Well, back then the difference was there was only everybody only had 3 channels. Some people I'd heard had 4, but it depends on where you live. Like, they might show something in Miami they wouldn't show in Oklahoma.
Sure.
You
know, everything was real local, and that's what I used to like about it. It was like, oh, your town has that. Now everybody's town kind of has the same stuff or whatever. I mean, we had more in Miami. We had ABC, NBC, CBS, PBS, and maybe 2 or 3 UHF channels. So we had a grand total of maybe 7 to choose from.
Oh, okay.
And that was enough. You know, they showed all the good stuff.
No, we had 3, and then sometimes the PBS would come on, but it wasn't on 24 hours.
You told me that.
Yeah, it'd be on, like, during school hours, because they show math and science, you know, lessons. And then after a while, in, God, it must have been 68, they started showing some shows in the evening, but it'd only be on for, like, 2-3 hours. And then eventually they started showing Sesame Street, so it didn't end when school was out. And it went on till a certain time at night, like 7, 8 at night, and then it eventually turned into what we all know now, where it's on 24/7.
I remember, and I can't think of the show that it was on, but I remember seeing some show, and it must have been in the late '60s, and I'm sure it was on PBS, but I could be wrong. It was kind of one of these, like, you know, music shows, but it was almost like some of it was classical or whatever, but Jethro Tull was one of the bands on it. I was like, who is this guy that looks like a vagabond playing the flute? But it made an impression on me, and I can't remember what it was, but I'm damn sure it was PBS. If it wasn't PBS, it was like one of those, like, CBS, like, you know, like more of a classical avant-garde kind of music show that would put on Sundays, maybe, and Tull was on it. I was like,
you know, here's a weird one when you're talking about Jethro Tull. When I was in middle school, that's when he had that song Bongle in the Jungle.
It's on War Child, yeah.
And they played it all the time on the radio. It was heavy rotation.
Sure.
And so whenever I think of Jethro Tull, I think of that song. And it was in the middle of the disco age. You know, I listened to this FM channel that was all the, you know, the pop hits and disco stuff. And I was in my room drawing one night, and they played Aqualung. I never heard it, and it was just one of those songs where it's like, all of a sudden, everything just turned dark and focused on one little thing, and I forgot where I was at. Talk about painting a picture with words.
Yeah, yeah.
And I kept imagining that Nick Cage, not Nick Cage, Luke Cage story in Marvel Comics at Christmas, you know, where Luke Cage is walking around New York City, and he runs into a beggar. Or this guy beating a kid, but he was like from the 18th century or whatever, Christmas past. And then at one point, he sees this Vietnam vet, you know, on a park bench, crazed. And he starts shooting everybody up, and Luke Cage has to stop him. Well, that Vietnam vet from the Marvel comic was what I kept imagining, and a real version of him in that song. And the way they were describing him, I'm thinking... And then every chord change and everything they did in that song, and I just forgot where I was at. I mean, that song grabbed me, and then also, my God, what is this song? I was breathing heavily, my heart was racing, and finally the song finished. I remember the DJ was Cracker Jack Walker, and he was kind of like, he talked like Weird Al did before Weird Al was around, and he came on and goes, and it was so different than any song they played on that radio station. And then when it finished, Cracker Jack, hey, it was Jethro Tull, Aqualung. Some people like it, and some people, who cares? And then he started playing like Donna Summer or something after it.
That's weird.
It was weird, but it was weird that I never forgot. And I was telling a friend of mine, you know, he was older than I was, about it. It was almost like, you know, like I saw God or something, you know, one of those religious things. And you know, he's like, this Jethro Tull, just get away from me. You know, and another friend of mine in high school, he started listening to Jethro Tull when I told him this story. He was buying the tapes. And then when he had Aqualung and I saw the cover, I thought, okay, that's kind of how I imagined the character. He described it so well. And then, you know, when Joe would play in the car in his VW beater, I'm like, man, it's just, I don't know, it's one of those songs, whenever you mention them, it was complete, because Bungle in the Jungle, to me, just seemed like a trite fluff song, you know, to me.
Aqualung's a better song.
Oh, yeah, Aqualung is just, you know, but yeah, it took me completely out of my environment.
What about Living in the Past? Did you like that one? The song Living in the Past?
Hum a few bars.
Oh, I can't, but you'll know it. You'll know it.
What are they doing? What are they singing?
Happy and I'm smiling.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know that one, yeah. Not, didn't make an impression on you. I like that one, too, actually. You know.
Well, the big song when they were playing Bungalow Jungle, it was Everlasting Love.
What year are you talking about? Like 77 or 74, something?
74, 75.
That early?
Yeah.
There was Donna Summer Disco in 74?
No, that's Aqualung, I heard.
That's Aqualung. You're getting the song.
That was in 77.
Oh, okay, yeah, that's what I was thinking. Yeah. 77, Donna Summer, 74, yeah. There's a lot of songs from that era. We're not even talking about comics at this point.
No.
We've gone off the deep end now.
Listen, comics and rock and roll go hand in hand.
They sure as hell do, don't they? And B-movies, too, as far as I'm concerned. It was like my media of the 70s. It was comics, B movies and rock and roll and stuff.
Well, that's one thing. My friend Britt always swore that if he ever did a comic book and had rock and roll, it wouldn't be like how Marvel and DC used to put rock and roll in it. Because I guess there was an old Nick Fury and the Howling Commandos, and they had a rock band in it. And Britt was saying, it's so bad. And as he was reading it, you know, we're all sitting at a table reading comics. And he goes, oh, now the musicians are hitting everybody over the head with the guitars. And I kept thinking was all these old DC and Marvel stuff, they put rock and roll in it, but these guys didn't listen to that kind of music. They weren't the audience.
No, they're all folky guys.
Yeah. And it was always so embarrassing. And I just thought that you couldn't really do good rock and roll in it. But then heavy metal came out, and you started seeing what the Hernandez brothers would do, and, you know.
Yeah, the Defenders got a little rock and roll. Like, who was the writer? There was the writer. I forgot what it was. I don't know if it was Kraft or somebody.
Steve Gerber.
Maybe Gerber was buddies with Blue Oyster Cult. So they showed up in an episode, in a couple of issues of The Defender. So they kind of tried.
Well, Jim Starlin, all of his comics seemed rock and roll to me. The Warlock stuff and all that. I mean, they didn't have rock bands in it, but.
Yeah, when the new guys started coming in, the Kaluta's Rights and stuff like that, they started it. It started to get a little hipper.
Well, there was more rock and roll. Yeah, it was the audience, you know, but.
Yeah. Yeah, they're college guys and stuff like that. Yeah.
But, you know, I don't know. It's you have to know your audience. That's what we talked about in the past show. We're talking about the cat and all that, and they're trying to appeal to women. You know, the newer comics, it does appeal to women. But the older comics is a bunch of men. All right, we need to appeal to these girls. Let's do something.
Well, because now women are more into comics than they were. Well, I shouldn't say that. The women are more into superhero comics. Back then, I'm sure they were into the Archies and the,
women always
the girls and the, the
Hernandez brothers, and all that. Their comics was their mother's comic collection, you know.
Their romance comics and stuff.
The mother
like
had
that.
Romance comics. She had Archie comics. She had
that does make sense.
She had all kinds of stuff. She did have Wonder Woman and Iron Man and some other stuff, but the comics they read was these huge boxes of comics her mom had when she was a kid.
That does make sense.
Yeah, it makes sense. But, I mean, my mom read comics, you know, and when I got comics, she read all of mine. And sometimes I would find out she knew about some of the stuff I'd see ads for. And I'd ask her questions, and she knew who Betty Boop was when I started seeing
it. Oh, sure, yeah.
I didn't know who Betty Boop was. I said,
she remember seeing the cartoon when she was a kid or something.
And I said, was she funny? No, well, she was okay, Mom would say. What did she do? And my mom wouldn't really tell me too much. And then I was in college when I saw a Betty Boop cartoon, and I was blown away, you know. And when I was telling my mom about that, I said, I saw an actual Betty Boop cartoon. And then I was trying to describe how she talked. You know, Mae Questel did the voice. And when I was telling my mom, she just looked at us, boop, boop, be doop. Why didn't you tell me that when I was asking you way back when I was little? So, I don't know.
Well, I mean, your parents probably saw cartoons and they read the newspaper strips.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's what they're, the knowledge was.
Well, it was, you know, Mom knew the Flash Gordon serials, and I did get to watch those when I was a kid on television.
She saw them. She went to the theater.
And it's one of those things, if you start talking or bring it up, they'll tell you. But when I'd ask questions, not knowing much about it, wouldn't tell you anything.
It almost seems to me like those serials back then where you go every week to see the next chapter. It's almost like Saturday morning cartoons in a way. You know, you went on Saturdays usually and you saw this serial, part two of the, you know, Captain Marvel or whatever, and then they played the movie afterwards.
This is something I never got to experience, but my parents would talk about it. When you went to the movie, they didn't just show some previews and then show the feature and you got out. They had a bunch of stuff. They had a newsreel. The way I learned about a newsreel was on Andy Panda. Remember those cartoons
Andy
from
Panda,
Woody Woodpecker?
Walter Lance.
But one episode, Andy Panda, his father said, "Don't go out there. You'll end up on the newsreel." And of course, Andy Panda, what's the newsreel? And the whole time, when it was Hunters or something, but Andy Panda just kept running out, and the father's trying to stop him. And Andy Panda says, "No, I want to be on the newsreel." And I watched the whole cartoon. I was like 9. I asked my dad, I says, "What's a newsreel?" And he says, "Before television, you went to the movies, and they had a newsreel that showed for like 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And it had all the features and stuff, and you got to see what Hitler was planning to do before the whole world went sideways, and, you know."
Yeah, the world at war, or news of the world, or
yeah,
whatever.
But
yeah.
They'd show all this stuff, and I really? And then one time on Carol Burnett, they had a skit about the Bowery Boys.
I love the Bowery Boys.
And I never saw them, and Mom and Dad's talking about it. I says, "What's the Bowery Boys?" Now, I was fortunate enough to get to see those Flash Gordon serials in Denver, Colorado on television. But all the Warner Brothers cartoons, Bugs Bunny, Porky Pig, and all stuff, there were shorts that they showed. They usually show 2 shorts, a newsreel, and then they show a serial, which is Flash Gordon, Captain Marvel, Batman, name a few.
Captain America, Shandy the Magician.
Yeah. They had pilots, they had magicians. They
Commander
had
Cody Rocket.
That's
Man
right.
Of the, you know.
But they had, you know, they had swashbucklers, they had all kinds. Some of those MGM DVDs you get, like I got Errol Flynn's The Seahawks.
Has a serial in it?
Well, they have the whole thing. They have the movie, but then the extras, they have there was some color, it was in color, but it was like flamingo dancers, and it was like a dancing soap opera, and it always had the same introduction, it had each dancer and what they were doing, and then it'd just be this dance. And I've got, I think Maltese Falcon, and what's the other famous Humphrey Bogart movie on? Casablanca.
Casablanca, yeah.
I got those, and they have the same thing, but they have a black and white cartoon. Huh. And one cartoon. They have a newsreel. They have those dancers. And I think they had a serial.
That was all day entertainment or all night entertainment.
And I guess the movies was a nickel to go to, and it was air conditioned. A lot of times whenever I'd read old books from the 30s and 40s, even in China, they would talk about, it's one of those Amy Tan books, the woman that wrote The Joy Luck Club. It was another one, I think Kitchen God's Wife. The girl was talking about her mother was upset about the father because some bad disaster was happening that brought doom on everybody. And the mother took the daughter and they went out of town and they just went to the movie theater and just sat there. And I said the mom could sit there and think, and it was air conditioned. Movie theaters were air conditioned while most of the world wasn't. And my dad said, my grandparents used to go to the movies when he was a baby so he'd go to sleep. And I'm thinking, really? And it was only a nickel, which I guess was probably a lot of money then, but it was, you know, it was a lot of entertainment, you know, and it wasn't just come in, go out, come in, go out. I mean,
it's funny because if movies were a nickel, comic books were a dime, so comic books cost more than movies.
Well, from what Neil Adams was saying on one interview, that the comic books back then, kids didn't have a dime, but they'd pull their money together to get it and they'd all share the book. So, you know, it wasn't cheap, but, I mean, it was affordable entertainment for kids. You know, going to the movies is probably, and they went to the movies, but it's probably tougher to go to the movies. You could get a comic and you'd have something everybody could read over and over again.
Yeah, it was, and then you'd listen to the radio and, you know, radio dramas and all that stuff, so, you know.
It's a whole world that doesn't exist anymore.
Hey, let's take another break, and then we'll play some more Mike Nesmith. And then when we come back, we promise we're really going to talk about comic books. Maybe.
Tell me again, but don't think that you'll convince me. Now you've said before falling in love again, you'd rather be dead. 'Cause when someone breaks your heart, you cry your eyes red. But there's nothing so hard about the life that you as far as I can see, there's no reason for goodbyes. You're just running scared, and that's something I won't buy. So you lose. I won't let you go with nothing to show but more blue. And all this talk about leaving is strictly bad. Settle down and stay with the man that loves you. Bad news. So you settle down and stay with the man that loves you. Yes, you settle down and stay with the man that loves you. Yes, you settle down and stay with me.
Again, and that was More Mike Nesmith. That was from this album here called pretty much your standard Ranch Stash and Son of Shelby's Blues from 1973.
What I like about that cover is on the right hand side he's winking and there's little tiny text right by his eye.
Buy this record. That is kind of funny, actually.
As a sense, you know, that's one thing, when I think of Mike Nesmith, I just think of the monkey with the little knit cap on his head.
Yeah, wool hat.
And I don't know, I was always surprised when people say he did his own albums. I still imagine that guy from the 60s with a knit cap on it, but,
You know, it's funny, too, is that when the TV show ended, and I didn't know this until later, they kept making a few records, and Peter Tork left the band, but it was Nesmith stayed, and it was Nesmith, Dolenz, and Davy Jones, and they put out a few records.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, about at least two or three.
I remember when the show ended, they were doing Kool-Aid commercials, and also
I've seen some of those, yeah.
And the Nerf balls came out, and they did the Nerf ball commercials, and it's still on the set, you know, that crazy house they lived in.
I never knew they put them. It was until years later that I found out that when the show ended, they were showing reruns on Saturday morning. I never saw them Saturday morning.
No, they in Oklahoma, they showed them on Saturday morning.
Yeah, it was on CBS. It was on a different network. I think they were on NBC, yeah. But CBS got the reruns and showed them on.
But they, even in Dallas, Texas, they used to show them all the time, like I think weekdays, you know,
yeah.
Around, you know, Speed Racer and everything else.
So they never really went away.
No, I always saw them. One of my best friends, when I was in middle school, he had a big poster of the band on his wall. And I never looked at the Monkees as a real band. You know, when I say that, the songs are fun. I liked them. I watched the show. But they used to do, Mickey Dolenz did, you know, like those K-Tel records? It wasn't K-Tel.
Yeah, but that commercial for Hits of the 60s,
yeah,
or something.
And he'd come out and say, "Hey, I'm Mickey Dolenz," you know, and he'd explain. And then every time they'd play one of the songs, they would have him doing something. And It always made my aunt laugh when they played Hang on Sloopy, and he's hanging out of a window for his life in some sky-rise apartment. And every time they would come on, they'd be playing Hang on Sloopy. And you know how he was always like over the top, and he's like grimacing. And my aunt would just bust out with uncontrolled laughter, you know. But yeah, you know, the Monkees did commercials for quite a while after that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was kind of like I saw it as a kid. And then I didn't see the Monkees for a real long time. I don't remember seeing any reruns, but I know they played them. It's funny when I look back, especially locally down in South Florida, how much stuff when I used to look at the before they took away my Google newspapers of Miami News and the Palm Beach Post, bastards. Now they're on a pay site. They used to be free for Google News Archives. It's funny how many shows they would play. That I didn't, oh, that was on? I didn't know they were playing that. You know, Ultraman was on in like the late 70s, early 80s on UHF channel. I never saw that. You know, yeah, a lot of that stuff.
They used to show in Oklahoma.
I never, you know, I guess I must have come home from school and did something else. Like, was out running around playing basketball.
I never watched them, but I remember the advertisements for it.
Never saw it.
You know, my daughter was small. Well, my daughter was small, and all the kids liked the Power Rangers.
I remember that.
This woman I worked with, she goes, her daughter was into it, and she goes, it looks like Ultraman to me.
Wow, really? She knew Ultraman?
Well, she was around our age. You know, this was a long time ago.
Wow.
Our kids were small.
And I never saw it on television. I saw Power Rangers. According to a friend of mine, he said, like, in the late 70s, Ultraman was on the early version of TBS. I think when it was TCG or something like that, it was really early.
Oh, yeah.
I go, oh, okay. You know, he said he went to some convention in Atlanta, and that's where he saw it. You know, I was like, oh, okay. You know, like I said, I never saw Ultraman. I never saw the Monkees again. I never saw any of those shows because I was in school, and I got home like at 4, and then I was out running around. You know?
Oh, you were living life. There's nothing wrong with
that. I was living
life,
man.
You were making yourself more interesting.
I was active. I was doing things. I was a go-getter. I was, you know, I wasn't just sitting at home reading comic books. That would have been later after I got home, you know. But was there ever a time that you didn't read comic books?
No. I know you've talked about it.
There was a couple of times.
There's times where I couldn't get them because there wasn't a store around the area that I'd be willing to go to. But every time I go out of town or if there's a store, I'd always go into it and buy it. Sometimes friends of mine would go out of town and they'd have a list of a couple of things and they always bring them back. So, no, I used to order off eBay sometimes.
Oh, I'm talking about in the 70s.
When I started getting comics, it was in, I always got them, but it was in 70, I think the end of 1970 when I started buying them all the time with myself. I never stopped.
Could you ride your bike to get comics? Oh, that's cool. All right.
Yeah, there was a store on one end. It was a few blocks. You know, it wasn't real far. You could ride your... I used to ride my banana bike, the Stingray.
Oh, you had one of those.
Oh, yeah. Everybody had one.
No, I didn't. And then, I had the cheaper version of it.
But then I used to ride, they opened a mall up on the other side. It wasn't really a mall. It was like a little shopping center called the French Market Mall. And they had a bookstore. And they had two spinner racks in it. And I used to go there all the time. And that's when Marvel's... This is in early 70s. And that's when the Marvel's started coming out all the time. You know, you could get a bunch of them. Before, it was mostly... Once in a while, you'd find a couple of Marvels, but... It was almost like when you go to Burger King and you order fries and there's an onion ring in your fries.
Yeah.
That's what Marvels were like, you know.
The other day, I went to Wendy's and had chicken nuggets and there was a french fry and the chicken nuggets. I go, hey, extra special fun here, you know.
That's what my daughter always said, Dad, why sometimes you get onion rings? Well, she said that she liked them. She'd eat it. But she, why do you get an onion ring? I don't know.
Still make onion rings in fast food places? I know we're going way off topic. I haven't had an onion ring from McDonald's or anything like that in years.
No, McDonald's, I don't think they ever did it. But no, Burger King does.
That's right. I forgot about that.
But for a while, Burger King had a little quote on their french fry pack about randomness in life and how it's, you know, sometimes you get an onion ring and your french fries, don't get upset, be happy that you got something special.
Yeah, right.
And that's how my daughter always was about it.
That's like every once in a while I get like some chocolates. Like I think Dove has some like sayings in them when you open it or whatever. And you know what else does that too? I had a Snapple iced tea the other day. They have sayings in them too. You know?
We don't have
any advertisement with anybody, by the way. Yeah, we'd love to sell ourselves for money,
Taco
but
Bell.
We can't.
Taco Bell on their hot sauce packages, they always have little sayings on them, and sometimes they're kind of random. It's not just one saying for each pack.
I didn't know that.
It's kind of fun. I like it when they give you stuff. They reward you for paying attention. Your little things you're not expecting.
Yeah, it's kind of fun. Every once in a while, you see, like, you open up the wrapper, and there's actually, like back in the old days when you got Bazooka Gum, there was, like, a cartoon with Bazooka Joe.
Yeah, comic.
Who drew those, man? Do you even know?
Yeah, well, I don't know the old ones, but in the 80s, Howard Cruz, the cartoonist, did
Howard Cruz drew Bazooka Joe for the...
Interesting. He was in a Comics Journal. But I remember, as funny as it was, this on the ship, this one guy from Texas got a package from his girlfriend. And she sent two boxes of Bazooka Joe. You know, they're little boxes. But the little bubble gum. Huge, huge hit. You know, every once in a while, Whitmire would be walking around passing out, "Hey, here, have some." Okay. It was fun. You got to chew bubble gum. There was a comic in it, you know, and... They weren't the old comics that I used to read in the 60s and early 70s, which I guess those things were probably made in the 50s. They were new comics, and they were a little slicker. And what surprised me is my division officer, the lieutenant, he kept coming up and asking, "Whitmer, I want some bubble gum." You know, this guy was a total aristocrat, you know, and everything.
Yeah.
Everybody likes bubblegum, you know, but
sure.
Part of it is, you know, you're surrounded by gray metal all the time and, you know, nothing but grease and work. Kind of exciting when you get bubblegum with a comic. But some of those were kind of, I mean, you know, it was only like 3-4 panels and they were always corny, stupid jokes. But one of them I really liked, and it was Howard Cruz, and I read about him in Comics Journal, that a lot of cartoonists freelance for Tops. You know, doing
Tops,
all,
yeah.
You know, all
sure.
this stuff. And they
Hollywood.
Said, yeah, and they said it was a gold mine for freelancers. But Howard Cruz, for a long time, did some of those Bazooka Joes. And one of my favorite ones, it was, they had a character that wasn't in the old ones. He was called Shades. You know, he had sunglasses all the time. But there was this blonde girl saying, "Joe, what kind of music does your band play?" And Bazooka Joe is at a grill. It goes rock and roll. When it shades off, says, "I'll say." And then he said, "Well, have you heard Joe's band?" And then he's holding a hamburger and says, "Oh, I thought you were describing his hamburgers." Rock and roll. It was stupid, but I thought that was kind of funny.
I just remember Bazooka Joe, the one guy that wore the red thing
Mort.
That covered half his
Mort.
Face. What was his name?
Mort.
Okay.
M-O-T.
Mort. Okay.
M-O-R-T.
Yeah. I don't know what
he was. Well, he had a turtleneck sweater. And there was Mort. He was the one you always recognized. Bazooka Joe had an eye patch and continued to have an eye patch.
That's right.
And then there was two guys that kind of looked the same. They were kind of baldy, thick guys, short, thick guys. And the old stuff, there was a kid called Pee-wee that had a yellow suit with a big yellow Mexican hat. He was, I guess, supposed to be a cowboy hat or something. But, yeah, those are fun.
The humor on Bazooka Joe reminded me, I wouldn't be surprised if they were been written by Ernie Bushmiller.
Yeah.
They were just kind of like, huh? That's funny?
Yeah.
You know, because Nancy is one of the strangest experiences ever of a comic strip, you know. It's just like, what? You know, it's almost like surreal, and it interests me because I'm trying to figure out who the hell thought this was funny. You know, Ernie Bushmiller must have been a very strange man.
Yeah, you know, the thing about Nancy, when I was a kid, I always recognized, I mean, I'm talking a little before I read the newspaper, but it was a real stark graphic style.
Sure.
And I always knew, whenever people talk about the comics, I'd always think of Nancy. And especially her hair, how the hair was like a straight hairdo, but it had the little pricks coming out like a, I always thought of a cactus, you know.
I thought she had an afro, anyway.
Well, I think, you know, it was kind of an afro, but it had the little
sticks coming out of it.
But you know, when I started reading comics, I always read Nancy. I never thought it was funny, but it was a star. It was
you never
a star,
thought it was funny, huh?
It was a star graphic style, so I would always read it. And then it was when I was in high school, one of my best friends who was into comics, he would just constantly go on about Nancy, how much he hated it, and why is it in the paper.
Yeah.
And one of his complaints was it was a daily strip, but it said, they were talking about the food prices. This isn't when the oil recession was going on in the mid-70s,
yeah.
And, you know, all the prices are going up, and food prices are going up, and people were complaining. And Sluggo was saying, when they were complaining about it, he said something about, you know, you're right, because I was just at the grocery store, and it said it was $3 for bananas. And then they showed it, and Nancy said, that's bandanas. That was the punchline. Bandanas,
yeah,
$3.
Yeah,
well.
See, I do like corny jokes.
Well, it was, you know, it was okay. But even my dad, he always read the my dad didn't really care for comics and stuff, but he always read the newspaper strips. And one time he was saying, it's not funny, and you don't see people look like that. But it had a graphic style. Now, one thing that blew my mind was she had an aunt that took care of her, Aunt Fritzy.
Fritzy Ritz.
And I was going to say, it was in the newspaper. One time I had an article that Ernie Bushmiller did Fritzy Ritz, and that's where Nancy came out of.
Oh, Fritzy Ritz was first?
Yeah, she had her own strip, and it was kind of a glamour girl strip.
Yeah, sure.
And later Nancy came about in the strip. I don't know how it turned into Nancy, but Aunt Fritzy was in the strip.
Sure she was, yeah, I remember.
And even in the 70s, she still looked like a 40s glamour girl kind of thing.
Yeah, she did, yeah. Didn't she have polka dots on her dress
or polka dots, yeah.
That was the first time I remember. I was over at my friend's house, and like I was looking at some comics or something, strips, and my friend's dad just looked at Nancy. He goes, man, that's the stupidest comic strip I've ever read. And I'm like, wow, that's the first time I've ever heard somebody like, you know, throw some, you know, shade on Nancy or whatever.
I've heard a lot. But, you know, it's all subjective, because what one person loves, another person dislikes.
Pretty much.
That, what was that comic strip, Kathy? I don't know if it's still in the paper.
Oh, I don't even know.
It started in the late 70s, but it's about Why are you blowing me off on this?
No, I'm saying, yeah, everybody hates that crap. Or
well, here's what I was saying. Kathy came out.
That was terrible.
And everybody said that, but there was a girl I went to high school with, and one time she saw me drawing cartoons. You know, she was good looking. I kind of liked her. And she came over, was hanging out with me. Pretty nice person. I really liked her. And then she said, I've never really read comics, but I read a couple of strips in the paper. What do you read? I can't remember what one was, but the other one was Kathy. And, I mean, you can see she loved it, and she goes, I like it because it's stuff I do. And basically, you know, it was always this kind of anxious girl that, you know, her life was out of control. And, but my dad, a lot of my friends hated the strip, you know. People I was in art class, why would they even allow that? But it was about her life, and she had an audience. I mean, it stayed
sure,
in the paper for a long
audience,
time.
Yeah. Charlie Manson had an audience, too.
Yeah, well, but I'm just saying that just because everybody, there must have been a lot of people that liked
somebody liked
strip,
it. Because a lot of people must have liked it because it got into the Sunday funnies or whatever, into the funny papers or whatever.
Yeah, and I can't talk because a lot of times comics that I love dearly only last one or two issues and they're gone, and I'm always like, why, you know, so.
Yeah, I know, it happens sometimes.
All the time to
me. But yeah, Kathy was like, I never read that. I mean, what was the other one? There was another one that was like, but again, there were the girl strips or whatever. There was some other, you know, that, and you know which one I never got into, but I think it wasn't bad, I never got into it, was Andy Capp. I just never...
Well,
it was too maybe British.
See, to
know.
Me, that was like Nancy. It had a style that you recognized. I always knew him. But, one, I'm not from a... Our family didn't drink, you know. We just didn't. I didn't understand, you know, this guy hanging out in the pub so late, coming home so late. Okay? And it was in the papers when I was on the ship, and this one guy from Los Angeles... He was telling me, he says, the only strip he really likes is Andy Capp. Why? He says, well, it reminds me of me. Because he would do those things. He'd stay out late, and his wife would get mad when he'd come in late. So, I don't know. I never cared for it. One thing I did like was that they used to have It's kind of like potato chips. They were like fries, handicaps fries you could buy as potato chips. But they were kind of like Cheetos or something.
Crisps, I think they call them. Yeah.
It was in the United States.
Yeah, okay.
But it was handicaps, I think hot fries. And you could get them like with ketchup. But it was just, you know, like Cheetos or something. I never ate them, but he looked neat on a potato chip package. So
I just remember, and I could be wrong on this, but I seem to remember that it used to piss me off that on the Miami Herald Sunday Funnies, which we used to get the paper all every Sunday, Andy Capp was right there in the beginning, in the front.
Yeah.
But we didn't get Prince Valiant. The Miami News got Prince Valiant, but not the Herald. So I was like, why don't we get Andy Capp and not Prince Valiant? Obviously, the superior comic strip, because people like to laugh at Andy Capp, I guess. But it was back then, I seem to remember, it was on the first page. I was like, why?
Yeah, Andy Capp, for a lot of papers, it was on the front. It didn't run in the Oklahoma paper, but it ran in the Texas paper where my family's lived.
I hope I haven't offended any Andy Capp fans, but saying, you know, everybody has their preferences, you know. But that was another one that was kind of like, yeah, okay, you know. And I mean, you know, if you go back and you look at the comic strips from that era, there's a lot of them that you're like, huh? You know, I mean, okay, yeah, whatever. But, you know, now they're kind of, they still have them. I mean, you know, they still do them. You know, they're still like the Sunday Funnies and the Tampa Tribune.
And the daily paper. Actually,
and they do carry Prince Valiant in there. So.
Yeah, and they have a lot more strips than they had back in the 80s when I read the paper religiously, and even the 90s. But the only thing is, in the Tampa paper, they're so small, and they kind of squish them to put more in. They got a bunch, but it's a page and a half. And they never had that much when I read them before. It was always one page, and it always had a puzzle, you know, the jumbo and the crossword.
Yeah.
But my wife, she loves doing puzzles. Every time she gets the paper, she does the Sudoku, she does the jumbo, and she does the crossword. And she always has a little stack of folded papers for those puzzles. And we just had to fly out of town recently. And our flight was canceled, so we got to spend time at the airport. It was fun. But
it was fun? Did they have a newsstand there? Did they have comics or anything there?
No, but I was reading Dallas's The Mighty Blue on my iPad.
Okay.
But at one point, I stopped, and my wife said, she always has several of these papers with her while she's doing the puzzles. And then she said, honey, there's comics on here. So I unfolded, and I was just sitting there reading one after another. I read, you know, like 2 weeks' worth of stuff sitting in the airport. And there are some kind of unique strips. I mean, they're different than other ones that I've never seen before. But I don't know. They're fine. I'd like it better if they could make them a little bit bigger, you know.
Easier to read, maybe?
Well, you can read, but how many times have you seen... We were talking about those Marvel Treasury Editions and the DC Limited Collector's Items. They're big. And I like the standard comic size, but like sometimes you see some of the French comics, like Valerian, when... Byron Priest. He did three Valerian stories in one... Yeah. One volume, and I was excited to get it, but it was a little bit smaller than a standard American comic. Well, it wasn't meant to be this small, and it loses something. I don't mind it if it's small, but if you got a regular page and it's drawn for that, and they shrink it down to nothing, it's, you know, it's no good. But that's the issue I had with them, and like the comics, they shrunk them down to postage stamps, and okay. I'm not really that interested.
The Sundays are bigger, though, aren't they? Or no?
Yeah, they're
in color too.
Yeah,
for the most part.
I hate to say it. I'm glad there's still comics in the paper, but is when Calvin Hobbes retired, I just kind of stopped reading them. And I was surprised because I always read the Sunday comics or the daily comics.
Do you still get the newspaper?
Yeah. Well, my wife does all the puzzles. You know.
Every day or just on Sundays or the weekends?
No, every day.
Oh, okay.
Every day. I don't... She gets coupons and she gets the puzzles.
Oh, okay.
Once in a while, I'll pick one up and read it, but rare. You know, once I got the internet, I kind of stopped reading it. And that's sad because I love the internet, but when I go on the internet, I'm looking up old rock bands. I'm looking up, you know, obscure books that I'm trying to find more information about. I look up martial arts and I look up comic books anyway, cartoonists, any of that kind of stuff, and soccer, which, you know, I'm looking for specific things that I'm trying to find. The beauty of the newspaper was you could read about local events and politics, local events and, you know, what people were doing. You could find out about, you know, local writers, local artists, you know, local construction workers.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you know, you could, there was opinion pieces, but it was a learning experience, and it was a whole spectrum. You know, you just find things out that you weren't even looking for anything. But when you have a chance, and when I say this, is greatness, that you can go on the world and find anything. You have access to anything you want. That's nice, but that's it. I'm looking for things I want. And sometimes it was good to find things that you didn't know that you would be interested in, you know?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So
that's like when you used to go to comic book stores and just without any preconceived notions, and you find stuff that, oh, that's cool, I'll get this, as opposed to, if you're going on Amazon or eBay, you have specific wants, and, you know.
Yeah, it's exactly it. Now, I don't know, it's like a lot of times people, it's one thing I started noticing back when there was MySpace. I met this guy who's still, he and I have become fast friends, this guy in New Zealand. And his MySpace page, it was all comic books, but he had like Ghostly Tales of Dr. Graves, you know, from
Charlton. Charlton stuff, yeah.
And it was books that I had when I was a kid, not that they were books I dearly loved, but they were books that I had. And he had all these books because he liked them, but they were, you know, he had regular stuff, but a lot of times when you see comic shops and stuff, it's always the greatest hits. It's always,
yeah,
you know, it's the seminal issues. It's the first appearance of Wolverine and Incredible Hulk. First appearance of Punisher and Spider-Man. The death of Gwen Stacy, you know, stuff like that. They don't have all the daily stuff that you see all the time, is what Bill Watterson said about Tuesday strips. You know, you can always get one knocked out, but it's the Tuesday strips is the one you really have to work on. And that's kind of how life is. You have to find, you know, it can't all be seminal greatest hits. Sometimes,
well, you know, think about it this way. When bands tour now, they're charging, especially the classic or the, whatever they call them, the legacy bands or whatever, they're charging a lot of money. So if you're going to go see, you know, a Steely Dan or somebody like that, you're going to want them to do their hits. As opposed to back then, they were just touring with their new album and, you know.
No, and that one, I think that's how it should be done. When you go see a band, I went to see Yes in 1979, and it was an experience that I carry with me to this day. That was my favorite band. Favorite show I ever saw. But in the program, it said that one thing that made them special, this is once they do an album, they never look back. They're always looking at the next one. Well, that's not true. After they did Close to the Edge, they look back all the time, but
yeah.
I loved it. But they said, when you see them in the show, you'll probably see, you know, hear a lot of their old songs. Well, they played everything off the new album, but they played all their old songs too. Well, how many times you heard about bands that have all this material, but you go and they just play obscure crap that nobody wants to hear?
It's, not often, but yeah, I have
seen. Yeah, I've heard it's not good, you know.
But if you get, let's say you go see whoever, and you like this one song that was like on an album, and you're hoping maybe, you know, you're not going to get it these days. You're going to get like, here's what they'll give you. They'll give you like, they're either touring and supporting an album, an old album. We're going to be doing. You know, whatever in its entirety, then that's kind of cool. But if they're just doing a greatest hits show or whatever, the people that are into the deeper, you know, tracks or whatever they call them, they're never gonna see it. You know, and the comic shop having the big titles is for just the regular Joe off the street. It's not for the guy that's looking for something different. You know,
Yeah, but we talk about this all the time. It's like
I can see why they do it.
The kind of comics I like, I'll buy them, but once I get my issue, they'll probably have the other issue on the stand for years and not be able to get rid of it, you know.
You know, I don't blame comic book dealers for having, you know, their best-selling books. The only problem I have with them is that sometimes that's all they carry, you know. Yeah. And they should carry a varied selection of things just because they're going to get a varied group of people coming in to buy their books, as opposed to just like people looking for, like, you know, the best, the most valuable issues or whatever. Speculators, you know what I mean? So, but you can't afford to buy every comic book anymore. You know, a comic book store, for the most part, can't buy one of each because there's too many.
Yeah, and I, you know, I've always heard that people say there's no way. So even in the 80s, a couple of guys I met were saying it's physically impossible to buy every comic that comes out. Well, I never wanted to buy every comic that comes out. I want to buy the ones I like, and then, you know, I don't like every comic ever made. You know, it's just, it's like everything else we talked about. Some people love them, some people don't on certain issues.
Yeah, but even stuff that you do like, some stores won't take a chance on it because.
Especially around here. Yeah, especially around here. It's just,
yeah.
I go to other cities, and, you know, other states, and they have all kinds. They got the mainstream comics everybody likes, and they got a lot of other comics that I enjoy. But around here, if you don't tell your dealer you want to subscribe to them, you're not going to see them.
You're not going to see anything but a Marvel and a DC, and maybe, like, I don't know, something. Usually it's something the store owner likes that they might go, oh, I used to like this book. They might order a few extra copies of it.
Yeah.
You know, like an adaptation of Planet of the Apes or something like that. But anything like that, it's like, forget it. You're not going to see it. That, you know, like getting back to what we said earlier in this segment, I remember a day when I could ride my bike to a comic to get comic books too. That's not happening anymore. I don't know anywhere around here that I can ride a bike to get a comic book.
Well, they don't have them in regular stores for people.
That's what I mean, you know?
I mean,
you can go to Publix and maybe get, like, oh, God, I went and saw, like, a Mad magazine there. They were, like, $8 or $9 for a Mad magazine. It's ridiculous. You know, who the hell would pay that much money? You know, it's all in color now, but I don't know. Remember when it was 25 cents cheap?
Yeah.
Oh, well. Hey, I think we're out of gas, so maybe we should end this party of comic book talk and other things.
That's kind of funny. When we said let's get to... we were supposed to do a couple of shows at Dallas recently, but I bailed on it. Sorry about that. But we got together. Also, I don't know what we talk about. I haven't read anything. I said, well, I have a couple of things to talk about. But we came, and as always, we just jumped all over the place. So
next time.
Yeah, next time. But
we'll have something to talk about.
Hopefully, we talked about enough comics to keep our audience.
And other things, too. Oh, God, yeah, we went off the deep end this time.
Anyway, and I apologize. I'm always asking for people to please give us an iTunes review, and we did get one.
Did we?
I'm embarrassed to say I can't remember the name. I will say it on, but I think it was Names Already Taken, or Clever Names Taken Already.
Was it a good review?
Oh, yeah, it was good, and thank you very much. I will say your name next time. I apologize. I wasn't prepared, and that's my fault. But thank you very much for writing this review, and if anybody else feels, it just takes a minute. If you don't want to write a review, just please rate us on iTunes. It just takes a second. And if you don't like us, I don't mind if you give us a bad rating, as long as you give us something.
So. If you say so. But I want good reviews only. I don't want bad reviews. I have a fragile ego.
Yeah, well, that's human nature there. Mm-hmm. Anyway, but thanks for finding us. You can find us on iTunes. You can also find us on Stitcher. Woohoo!
That's right. Stitcher.
So, anything else?
Wasn't there one called Podcast Alley? That's probably gone by now.
I've heard. I know Podcast Pickle is gone.
Oh, is it? Oh, okay.
But Podcast, I think there was a Podcast Alley. I'll look it up. Anyway, you got anything else you
want
to say?
I'm done, man.
All right.
I'm done.
He's done.
The next time I'll have more. So, I'll have more ammunition.
All right. So anyway, I guess that's it for us. Thanks for downloading the show and listening to us. And in the meantime,
read more comics.
You can find Al's other podcast, Slow Robot A Go-Go, Dallas' webcomic, The Mighty Blue, and Al's blog, Destination Nightmare, on the sidebar of our blog at bunchofdorks.com.
And click on the Cyclops!